From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a tough new look at Michigan's charter school authorizers.
This report has the first performance scorecard that actually gives authorizers grades for how they're doing.
We meet the highest-ranking Israeli diplomat in the Midwest.
The economic bridge between Israel and Michigan is, first of all, high-tech, mainly cyber, homeland security, agricultural industry, water industry.
Michigan's Chinese community celebrates the new year.
Even though it's still cold, but you can sense the coming of spring.
And with March Madness drawing near, John U. Bacon sizes up Michigan and Michigan State.
Not a flashy team, the Spartans, that is, but very solid, well-coached, and as Izzo's teams almost always do, they peak at the right time.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Opposition is growing to the upcoming speech by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Congress. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today we talk with the highest-ranking Israeli official in the Midwest. But first, more than 140,000 students in Michigan are in charter schools. And a report released today by the nonpartisan Education Trust Midwest gives a grade of D or F to 20% of Michigan's charter school authorizers. Amber Arellano is the executive director of Education Trust Midwest. Amber, what are the main findings in your report?
We have some really terrific high-performing charter authorizers in Michigan. Authorizers like the Grand Rapids Public Schools and Washtenaw Intermediate School District, they're running charter schools in Michigan that are doing a really terrific job for their students, especially for African-American students. But we also have some authorizers that aren't doing a good job, and they're actually expanding and approving public charter schools to open in Michigan that are so low-performing, they're actually significantly underperforming some of the worst public school districts in the country, like the Detroit Public Schools. You know, most Michiganders probably don't realize how important charter authorizers are to providing high-quality public education to all of our students. We wanted to kind of take a look at their performance for the first time in Michigan and sort of see who are the ones that are doing a great job, who are the ones that really should be doing a better job for our kids.
Before we get into some names, give everybody a good sense of exactly the powers an authorizer has in the role.
Yeah. Authorizers are hugely important. They have a lot of power to decide which charter companies or nonprofits can open charter schools in Michigan, which ones they should shut down, which ones they can intervene in to help them do better. The charter school sector now it's a really important sector in Michigan. It's about a $1 billion sector in terms of Michigan taxpayer dollars. Part of the reason why, as an organization devoted to making sure that Michigan becomes a leading education state, the reason why we wanted to look at this issue in particular is because as we've studied leading education states like Massachusetts and Tennessee, those states have very high-performing charter school sectors. And our charter school sector is not so high-performing. It's actually
it's up and down, right?
Very mixed bucket. Mm-hmm. And actually, Stanford University found that about 80% of our charter schools are underperforming traditional public schools, even when we compare for similar students, African-American to African-American students, low-income to low-income students. We wanted to think about how do we ensure that this sector is higher performing? How can we make it better? Some would say that we shouldn't be chartering schools in Michigan, that we should simply get out of the charter school business. We would say, no, this is really important. We have some terrific charter schools in the state. That's a really important tool in the toolkit that we have for providing high-performing charter schools, and especially in communities like Detroit, where the traditional public school district has struggled for so long mm-hmm. to deliver great education for all of its students. But we've just got to do it better. And the question is, how do we do that? We think that a big part of that lies with authorizers.
Kind of seems like it would start with whoever is authorizing the schools. It's kind of that's the heartbeat of it. Who did you find was not doing such a good job? Who's on the D and F list?
Eastern Michigan University is really struggling in terms of the quality of the schools that they're and operators that they're approving to open in Michigan. Detroit Public Schools also very low performing. So there was a handful of operators that got D's and F's.
Why?
Well, one reason is that we don't have any real set performance standards for charter authorizers in our state. When you look at a state like Massachusetts, the state doesn't say, good luck and let the markets decide. It says we're going to ensure a quality guarantee for our public school students. And that means that we're going to have high performance standards for our charter authorizers. And in a place like Michigan, we don't have that. There are no performance standards. And when an authorizer doesn't do a good job year after year, decade after decade, no one has the authority to actually shut them down. We don't have anything in place to really provide strong accountability for our charter authorizers. It's a really big issue at the state level, and it's something that we're going to have to think about in the coming years.
Any idea how many children are affected by, you know, these D and F grades in the schools that are being authorized by these folks?
So tens of thousands of students, and disproportionately represented by African American and Latino students. Today, more than 60% of kids in charter schools in Michigan are kids of color. And as you know, in cities like Detroit, gosh, I mean, half the students in Detroit now attend a charter school. So again, really important that we put things into place to make that sector more robust and higher performing.
Is this a message to the legislature and to policymakers in Lansing as much as it is to these authorizers that kind of are on this failing list?
Yes. And I think one of the things that we wanted to do was to bring nonpartisan data and research to bear on this policy conversation. It can often be charged and ideologically driven. What we need to do is sort of take a step back and look at the data and think about what we can learn from these high-performing states, right? We also wanted to bring to bear the data to just to inform authorizers' decisions themselves. This is actually a really important time of the year for authorizers. Many of them are making decisions about what schools will be approved to open or expand this coming fall. It's good for them to take a look at how are they doing in terms of their performance compared to other authorizers around the state. No one's ever done that before. This report has the first performance scorecard that actually gives authorizers grades for how they're doing. No one's looked at authorizer performance before. We hope that the data will help inform and help them improve their practices, decision-making about who to open in Michigan.
And what does this report say to parents?
It says that we have some really great charter authorizers and some great public charter schools. We have schools like University Prep Science and Math that are doing a terrific job, especially for students like African American students. But we have many, many more charter schools that are doing really poorly. In fact, so poorly that they're underperforming some of the worst public school districts in the country. And we've got a huge problem, and we've got to deal with that. We are not going to deliver better quality public education for all of our students if we don't get a handle on this problem.
Amber Arellano is Executive Director of the Education Trust Midwest, out with a new report, Grading Michigan's Charter School Authorizers. Always good to talk with you, Amber. Thank you.
Thank you.
Time now to check in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And John, we're just about 3 weeks away from the big day when the NCAA unveils its tournament field of 68 teams. I know that was on your mind when you watched Michigan and Michigan State the other night with that 80-67 Spartan win.
They looked pretty good. They looked like a very solid team. Not a flashy team, the Spartans, that is, but very solid, well-coached, and as Izzo's teams almost always do, they peak at the right time. He loads up his schedule in the non-conference section, November, December, with very tough teams, which very few teams do. Beilein does a fair amount of that at Michigan as well. And you take some lumps, and by January, February, you're playing better and better basketball, and now you're ready.
Almost like Marine boot camp or something. Start him out tough at the beginning.
Toughen him up. Take your lumps in November and December. And that's what he does, and that's what Red Berenson does in Michigan hockey as well. And those teams tend to peak at the right time.
So we see them growing into themselves as the season goes on.
Absolutely right. Now, in Beilein's defense, keep in mind, he's lost four players in the last 2 years of the NBA, and he's lost three starters this year to injuries. At one point, you had one starter on the court. It's a very tough way to win, obviously. They've been battling very well. They've taken three very good Big Ten teams, Ohio State, Illinois, and Michigan State, to overtime, lost them all. But he's getting the most out of what he's got. He just hasn't got much right now.
What do you think for next season?
They'll be demons because these guys are going to come back. They're getting their own boot camp right now. And I'll say this. What I think is the toughest time to coach is not when you're winning. When you're winning, everyone wants to show up. They don't want to go to the trainer. They'll play hurt. They don't want to lose their spot. When you're losing, all that stuff starts increasing. Nobody wants to go to practice. They're all dragging. The guy had a slight tweak in their ankle. Guess what? They're injured. All this stuff. Izzo did it a few years ago, and Beilein's doing it now. He's keeping his team together, keeping them from giving up, keeping them from pointing fingers. And if you can get through that, they'll be a whole lot tougher next year. This actually is a great coaching job.
The magic of coaching, talking about both Beilein and Izzo, when you look at that alchemy that happens between a team and their guy. My husband was commenting watching Izzo. He certainly was not happy with things he saw, the gestures, the covering his eyes.
If his team is on the court, he's not happy. And now off the court, he's great, and the players love him, and will take a bullet for the guy. But you very rarely see him happy while coaching. My joke this week in the commentary is that he always looks so exasperated, like he's watching a bunch of neighborhood ne'er-do-wells egg his house. But it works for him, man. Don't change it now.
And again, as you say, the team would take a bullet for him.
Absolutely. And look, this is the Beilein, too, no question. Carol Hutchins, softball coach at Michigan. Bo Schmeckler, the key to these guys, they're all very tough, but they love their players, and that's why they put up with it. And I've talked to Izzo's players 5, 10, 20 years after, or 15 years, I should say, after they're done, and they love that guy. And that, to me, is the acid test. What are they saying 10, 20 years later?
You know, it's interesting. Let's just throw another, not talking about college, but we'll throw a name in where I'm not sure that people love him, Scotty Bowman.
No one loved him. In fact, I interviewed Ken Dryden, the great goalie from the Montreal Canadiens who played for the great teams under Bowman in the 70s. And he said, you know, some guys like Vince Lombardi or Bo or Izzo are these cantankerous old guys, but down deep you love them and they love you. Not Scotty. He said, we loved him one day of the year when the banner goes up and we get a ring. And when I asked Red Berenson, Michigan hockey coach who played for Scotty Bowman at St. Louis, I said, who was your best coach? He said, well, measured by where I played the best hockey, Scotty Bowman, because he gets the best out of everybody. Everybody's uncomfortable, but they win. That's the thing about Scotty. You may not have liked him. He may not be your buddy, but you knew where he stood, and he was wired into you, and he knew it. So that's what great coaching looks like.
Fascinating to think about that. So what do you see coming up for March 15th?
Michigan State will be in, and Michigan almost certainly, sorry, will not be in.
What's the
key? Fact, right now, Michigan is fighting for a seed in the NIT, the National Invitational Tournament, which, by the way, years ago was bigger than the NCAA. That's a little known fact. But Michigan right now is on the bubble for that. So it's a tough year for Michigan. But Michigan State, my strong hunch, will be there.
And how far do you think they could go based on what you're seeing now?
This is not a great Michigan State team. It's not one of his best. But it often doesn't matter. Talk to any great coach, the teams that win the titles are not their best teams. They always tell me this. And the reason is the team that gets together and plays like a team at the right time. This team could be one of those teams. The fact is right now, nobody knows. But I wouldn't bet against him yet.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Ubick. And as always, thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
Still to come, we explore the slippery definition of the word innovation. That's on the next idea. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
The goal of the next idea is to shed light on ideas about innovation, ideas that could help move Michigan forward. The latest contributor with an essay for the next idea wanted to compare and contrast innovation as seen in his adopted state in Michigan and his home country of India. In short, a cross-cultural take on innovation. Deepak Singh is a graduate of business school in India. Now he's a writer based in Ann Arbor, and his essays appear regularly on Public Radio International's The World. Good to have you with us, Deepak.
Thank you very much.
In your essay, you write about that word innovation. It's one of those words, isn't it, that can mean so much, but we use it so often that sometimes it can mean not much at all.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, especially in India, when I was in school, business school, I mean, this word, I'd heard the word before I went to business school, but I heard it so much that it sort of began to lose its meaning. I mean, it just became a word that you wrote, you know, just memorize and you throw it around to sound like what you know, you act like, you know, I'm in business school, innovation. But but then it had a deeper meaning, and it's later when I graduated and I realized, you know, you could change businesses around and you could not have to, like, do the business as you've been doing for generations. In India, there are businesses who don't change for generations, like 5 generations. They're selling the same kind of suite, the same kind of people. They're kind of stuck the way they do the business. And if somebody comes along, it's like, you know, you could change a few things. You don't have to change the entire thing because you can make a slight difference and you can make attract a whole different base of customers which you didn't realize existed.
Well, then you had an extremely enlightening conversation with a local chai shop owner. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was. This is downtown Lucknow. It's a very posh place by Lucknow standards, and a lot of rich ladies and teenagers and businessmen hang around, and they have coffees in really swank-looking shops. And there's one little rickety old chai shop, which is like a tea stall. It's like a hole-in-the-wall place, which where I like to go because it was cheap and it was still in downtown. So I could just hang around there without spending hundreds of rupees. So one day, I was in business school at that time, and I thought, let me, you know, just try to coach this guy. Maybe he can make some more money. I told him, hey, have you thought, do you know anything about innovation? He said, what's that? What does that mean? I was like, oh, it means like, you know, you can just totally change the business, turn it around and make more money and improve, you know, on your financial status and also the way you market yourself. So he said, can you tell me more? I was like, you know, you are in a very posh place in Lucknow, but your shop kind of, you know, sticks out as very, like, you know, beat down and old and not very fashionable. So how about if you, like, you know, put in some nice sofas or cushy chairs and nice stove and serve chai instead of, like, you know, small, like, you know, chipped glasses? You can buy better crockery and raise the price from 10 rupees to 50 rupees and, like, 10 times more, you can just turn your fortune around in, like, you know, in a week. He said, you know, let me tell you one thing. I said, what is it? He said, you know, I cater to a very special group of people. I have a niche. All these drivers who bring all these rich ladies and, like, you know, they drive around rich people's kids, they are the ones who come here and have chai. Because while their ladies, their masters, their ma'ams, madams, and their bosses are shopping around in big showrooms, they cannot afford that. So they come to me or have 10 rupee chai while they're waiting around for their bosses. So, I mean, if I change it, if I just change my shop around and, like, make it look like every other shop, they'll be scared. They will never come to me. They think, you know what, there's no place for them to go in this particular area. So it would be a good way for my business to get ruined. Uh-huh. So I thought maybe innovation is not always a good idea.
Or maybe don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, yeah, exactly. As that old saying goes. I'm interested, Deepak, you have a daughter who is in school here in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And now that you're watching your daughter through her education, how does that compare to what you went through and what kids in India are encouraged to do?
When I was going to school, when I was my daughter's age, she was like 5 years old, my parents wanted me to become an engineer and focus on mathematics. And every school had this focus, you know, if you're not smart in math, you kind of, like, you know, it's embarrassing to tell people that you failed in math. And it's not, if you say, like, oh, my kid is good in arts, it's like, oh, what a loser, you know. But it was always about science and maths. And this is still true in a lot of places in India. But my daughter, I mean, America had a more, you know, growing up in India, I saw Americans excel in tennis. So why couldn't we do well and win in U.S. Open or Wimbledon, and why Americans or other West Coast, because they focus on other, like, sports, it's not only about education. So my daughter is now, she's going to a kindergarten where there's a focus on science, technology, engineering, arts, and maths, which is sort of like what I had seen in my days. So, but I want, I wish that America doesn't lose that, the broader sense of education, because they also have arts, they have the other perspective, and it's not only about math, it's not only about science, so they can have a broader view about socializing skills. And so that is one difference which I just saw with, mm-hmm. with my daughters.
When you go back to visit India, do you see a strong drive with people there to emigrate and head elsewhere, or is it more the other way around, let's try to get folks to come home to India?
When I left, it was more like about leaving India and going to America or England, Australia, places where they could speak English and not mm-hmm. have to learn the language and still do well. But now there's a new term in India being talked about. It's called reverse brain drain. So they want to bring the minds who are creating wealth in America, bring it back to India and do businesses here, invest back in India. So it is starting to change.
Deepak Singh is a writer who is based in Ann Arbor, and you can find his essay at the Next Idea link at michiganradio.org. Share your thoughts on his essay in the comments section under the essay or at Michigan Radio's Facebook page or on Twitter at NextIdeaMI. Deepak, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Happy New Year! Today's the first day of the Chinese New Year. There are celebrations happening worldwide to welcome the Lunar New Year and bid farewell to the old. Lianyu Fu is with us. She's the Chinese Studies Librarian at the University of Michigan. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cindy.
How would I wish you a Happy New Year? What would I say?
The most common way is 新年快乐 or 春节快乐. 新年 means New Year, but 春节 is a spring festival. This is a more common way in China that we call this special day 春节. Yeah.
And this really is, the Chinese calendar is a lunar solar calendar, so it's different from the Gregorian calendar that we know. So this is the start of spring, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. So in China, we call it a spring festival because we consider this as the start of a new year, so start of spring. So you can feel, even though it's still cold, but you can sense the coming of spring. Yeah,
there's hope there. Lianyu, I had the pleasure of being in Chinatown in Honolulu in January of 2011 for the magnificent parade and the dragon dancing along the street and little children running up to put dollar bills in its mouth and the firecrackers and cymbals and music.
Sure.
And that was the year of the rabbit. What is this year?
Oh, this year. So this is the year, the first day of the year of goat.
Goat. Well, what will you do to celebrate here in Ann Arbor now for the Chinese New Year?
Well, what I usually do is I will prepare a special dinner for New Year's Eve, and I will eat the leftover on the New Year's Day and maybe for another couple of days. I will prepare some special food. For example, I will make the Chinese dumplings. Also, I will make the rice cake. The reason for that is rice cake is very traditional Chinese food for the New Year because of its name. It's made of the sticky rice. But the name, the pronunciation of rice cake in Chinese is nian gao. So nian means new year and gao means high. So together, nian gao indicates that you will achieve higher and higher goals in the new year. So like have a very prosperous year. Yeah. And another food I have to prepare is the fish. Even though I make this dish, but I never eat the fish inside. This is also a tradition in China. So the name for fish in Chinese is yu. Yu, as a character, the pronunciation can also refer to surpluses. So having a fish on the dinner table, but you don't eat it, so the fish is still there, which sounds like "年年有余." We called it. So every year we have fish. So it also means every day of the year we will have a surpluses. It means that we will have an abundant year. Yeah.
How about decorations? Do you decorate?
Oh yeah, definitely. I have a box of Chinese traditional decoration. I brought them with me when I traveled to the States. There are a couple of things there. The red lantern, the winter flower. We call it Chuanghua winter flower, which is paper cuts, the red colored paper cuts. I always paste them on the window. It's very, very nice. And also I have the couplets. So the New Year couplets are written by my grandpa. So my grandpa practiced calligraphy. So he always wrote some very nice couplets with the blessing on it. So I put them on the door. So there are so many interesting things in my house now.
I'm wondering, Linyu, what is the symbolism of red? Because it certainly seemed red is a very, very important. I remember it from when I was in Honolulu. Red is a big deal.
Well, I think maybe different country and different people have their own preference of color. And then red seems to be a color loved by Chinese. So one thing that I heard why Chinese people like red very much is because this nian. So nian actually means year. But at the very beginning, nian actually referred to a beast. So a beast that people try to avoid, because this beast called nian well came out from the mountain and to harass people at this day of the new year. So in order to scare off this nian, this beast, so people will fire the firecracker. And then especially because nian is very much a fair of the red color, so people use red color all the place in their house. They will dress red and then do many, many things and they include a red color in order to scare off this nian, this beast. So this is the story that I heard, then I would believe it is true. So,
and how many days will the celebration last?
Usually, I remember that when I was in China, the celebration lasts for at least 15 days from the first day of New Year and to the 15th days. But actually, the celebration starts maybe earlier than the Spring Festival, because people have to prepare for the New Year. They have to go shopping, they have to prepare food, and then they have to travel to get together with their families if they're not living together. So you will have time to prepare for all these. And usually at the eve of the New Year, family will get together to have a dinner together, and they will stay up after the midnight. Yeah, that's the tradition.
And bring in that new year.
Sure.
So will you end by wishing everyone a very happy new year in Chinese?
Oh, yeah. 祝 Michigan Radio 的听众新年快乐,羊年吉祥,身体健康,谢谢。
So you said to everybody?
Yes. Yeah, so I said, wish the audience of Michigan Radio Happy New Year, and especially Happy New Year of goats. Have a healthy and happy year. Yeah.
Lianyu Fu, who is the Chinese Studies Librarian at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for sharing with us, Lianyu.
Thank you so much for having me, Cindy.
The 87th Academy Awards happens Sunday night. Many would consider winning an Oscar to be the pinnacle of success for an actor. But what of the Oscar curse? Does winning that little gold man bring misfortune?
Yes and no. There's a curse, but it's not the curse we normally think it is.
That's Michael Jensen. He's a strategy professor at the Ross School of Business at U of M. Jensen studied actors who played lead roles in over 1,000 top commercial films from 1930 to 2005. And he found, yes, there is a curse, not career, but rather the winners' love lives, especially the men.
What we found in our studies is that male actors are more likely to divorce after being nominated or winning an Oscar compared to not being nominated at all. So there is a real Oscar curse, but the Oscar curse is personal, not professional.
I'm kind of curious why it is that the men are more likely to divorce than the women.
So I think that there are two things at stake here. If you win the Oscar, you suddenly move up in a social hierarchy, and you're suddenly exposed to a lot of new opportunities you didn't have before, including opportunities to engage in behavior that is not good for your marriage, such as, you know, extramarital affairs and so on. And we know from other studies that males tend to be more likely to act on these opportunities than women. If you're nominated but not win, on the other hand, we also know from other studies that men tend to be more aggressive or more disappointed in their reaction to those kind of like, oh, I almost got it, but I didn't. So what we are showing in this study is that participating in these type of high-stakes tournaments can have consequences personally. And it seems like women are then better at handling those kind of rapid transitions in their professional lives. At least it's not reflected negatively on their marriages.
Something to think about as we watch them walk the red carpet on Sunday night, and I guess to Best Actor nominee Benedict Cumberbatch, who only got married a few days ago. I guess we say good luck, we think.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And we hope that he's smart enough to really think about it. Oh, my God, if I win this Oscar, it'll be wonderful for me professionally. But now I have to keep myself grounded in who I am and why it was in the first place that I ended up being so successful, and not, you know, do like we see many actors do. Suddenly they begin to change, and they begin to, as we quote a marriage counselor in our study, take advantage of all these extramarital opportunities that pops up and suddenly becomes very salient for them. But it's, of course, not only actors. We see it in all different kind of professions. You know, you can think of a Justin Bieber suddenly getting very, very famous and popular and out of control. But you can also think about CEOs moving up in the hierarchy, suddenly getting a lot of attention and beginning to do all different kind of non-productive things. Things that they might find natural to do, because I'm the king of the hill here. I'm the big shot, right? So I should have a little more leeway in my behavior, but it can be punished.
Some fascinating insights. Michael Jensen, professor at U of M's Ross School of Business. Michael, thank you so much.
Sure. My pleasure. And thank you for calling me.
Still to come, we'll speak with the ranking Israeli diplomat in the American Midwest. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It could have been the story of a company's ruin following a 2005 bankruptcy. Instead, Delphi Automotive is a Wall Street love story, but at what cost to its American workforce? Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here now for our weekly check-in, and you had a rare interview with a rare bird, a CEO who took a major auto supplier into bankruptcy, threw it, survived it, and the company is stronger than ever. Tell us about Rodney O'Neill.
Well, he's a very interesting cat. I mean, he grew up in Dayton, Ohio, and worked in a career in the Detroit auto space for more than 40 years at GM, and then later at what became Delphi, and rose up through the ranks. But, you know, it's very rare that a CEO would take a company into bankruptcy, keep it in there for 4 years, including through the global financial meltdown and the bankruptcy of General Motors, come out and run it for another 5 years. That is a real vote of confidence by his investors, and also a vote of confidence in the business plan that they put together.
Give us a sense how bad things were for Delphi and why.
They filed their bankruptcy, only their United States operations, in 2005 because they had two contractual problems they could not change outside of bankruptcy. One was their relationship with General Motors, and two is their relationship with their labor unions, principally the UAW, but also the IUE. And so here we are, however many years later, their business with General Motors has dramatically declined, and it's grown all over the world with other manufacturers. And secondly, there are no UAW-represented plants for Delphi in the United States anymore. More than 95% of this company's employees live and work outside the United States. That's not a popular message here, clearly. But I think the alternative is that the company could have ceased to exist because they were not going to be competitive financially in the model that they had.
And this company, as you point out in today's column, is just rocking it. In fact, it's ready to on track to become a tier zero supplier. Is that the creme de la creme?
It's like a mega supplier. I think they're viewed as somebody who will continue to grow and be very powerful. You know, at 2005 to 2009 time frame, they started to implement a strategy that they call Safe, Green, and Connected, which is very simple language to say that we're going to focus on safety technologies, environmental and green technologies, and infotainment and electronics. And if you know anything about new cars today, you'll know that those are some of the three most important attributes that all new vehicles focus on. So they really have positioned themselves for the longer term to be able to play out these trends as they go forward. As he put it to me, he says, when we picked these things in 2005, these areas were lukewarm. They've only gotten hotter, and they will continue to get hotter.
Well, we have to talk about the cost to the American workforce. It's certainly all over your story. You've got Wall Street happy. The board of directors is happy. But as you pointed out, Delphi's gone from 47,000 U.S. workers to just 5,000 and moved the headquarters from Troy to the U.K. Why the U.K., which certainly isn't noted for giving tax breaks?
Well, there are tax advantages. We've seen this with other companies that have come out of bankruptcy, or, you know, the new Fiat Chrysler automobile, NV, as they call it, NV, because it's actually incorporated in Amsterdam, and its corporate headquarters are in the U.K. as well. This is a new kind of trend in American business. But I think the bigger question here is not just the workers in the United States. I mean, that is an issue, clearly. But the real injustice of the Delphi bankruptcy and the aftermath is what happened to its salaried retirees.
Yes, we were getting to that next. Please.
Yeah. And I've written a lot about that over the years, as has my colleague in Washington, Dave Shepherdson. They got shafted, and they got shafted in the decision-making by what were then the private equity investors and the Obama task force, who needed to get Delphi out of bankruptcy in order to get General Motors out of bankruptcy. Mm. And, you know, they did back and stand behind the union pensions for the UAW and later for the IUE, but they made a political decision, essentially, to say that the salaried workforce are not a constituency, we don't have to do this. And so they didn't do it. The irony today is that Delphi had argued in their first two reorganization plans, hey, we can afford this pension. We can come out of bankruptcy. Give us time as this business plan kicks in. We'll be able to afford it, and everything will be fine. And the people making the decision said, no, if we're going to do this, we're leaving those guys behind. And what's happened is the company has been proven right. I mean, they have quadrupled their share price. Their financial performance is a darling within the sector. And had they kept that pension, it's likely they could have continued to fund it and things would have been fine.
Knowing that there are retirees who gave their working lives to GM and then to Delphi, and then some of them saw their pensions, as you point out, slashed by some two-thirds, is there any move now that Delphi is chugging along and humming along to maybe try to make things right with those retirees?
Well, this is, it gets very technical, but I would say this. There has been an ongoing legal case in that I'm not sure exactly where it stands right now. The problem is that the Delphi we're talking about today is legally and technically a separate company. The claims that those people might have would be against the old Delphi. And the question is there any money left in that company? I mean, a lot of it's been wound down. So even if they were to win the legal case, the question becomes, how would they get compensated? So, you know, I think a lot of people kind of think that this thing is in reality pretty well done. You know, it was an issue to some extent in the 2012 presidential election, and I think once President Obama won re-election, it ceased becoming an issue from a political standpoint. So, you know, it's not over, but how that's ultimately going to play out, I think they're just going to have to let the wheels of justice kind of grind on and see where it leads.
In the last few seconds, can you give us an overarching lesson that other companies can learn from Delphi or from Rodney O'Neill?
Oh, boy. Have the right strategy and lead and focus on value creation. I mean, he talks about if it doesn't create value for the company, I don't do it. And for a lot of years in this town, that was not the overarching philosophy of how they run the auto industry.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
From attacks on Jews in Paris and Denmark to controversy over Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's upcoming speech to the U.S. Congress, Israel is in the news. Rory Gilad is the Consul General of Israel to the Midwest.
We basically represent the interests of the State of Israel in the Midwest.
He's based in Chicago, but joined us in the studio, where we talked about the economic ties between Michigan and his country, including the auto industry.
We don't produce cars in Israel, but General Motors has a huge R&D center in Herzliya. Our high-tech industry produce elements that can help cars.
And political ties.
For instance, we took Governor Snyder to Israel in June 2013, which really gave a boost to the relationship with Michigan.
Gilad worked for more than a quarter century in Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He's worked in Kenya, Jordan, the UK, before coming to the Midwest.
I think people of the Midwest are very receptive, are very friendly, willing to listen. You don't get much radicalization here. People are, whether Jews or Christians, even Muslims, mm-hmm. they are willing to listen, open for a dialogue. They have a lot of interest as for what is happening in Israel, economically, academically, politically, of course. For me, basically, that's the place I was looking for, because not always in my career I enjoyed an environment that was so open for a dialogue. And that's, I think, the thing that really attracts me in the Midwest. People are very open, very friendly. And even if they do not agree with you, they always listen.
I'm glad to get the chance to ask you about some of the things that really are on people's minds. Israel, certainly in the news.
Please.
With the biggest political issue being that of the Prime Minister's speech in front of the United States Congress, and that'll be on March 3rd, invited by Republican Speaker of the House John Boehner. And it's clear that that invitation took the Obama administration by surprise. The word furious is being used. How would you characterize the Prime Minister's actions?
I think that I can understand and appreciate the protocol blunder that was made. And maybe things could have been done differently. But at the end of the day, I believe it is more than just protocol. I think what brings Prime Minister Netanyahu to address the Congress, which after all is the reflection of the American people. And Prime Minister Netanyahu has some real and significant concerns that the agreement that might be signed between the P5 plus one and Iran is a bad agreement, is an agreement that can cast a shadow over the future of the Jewish state 6,000 miles east of here. And he feels that as there is a price to pay for addressing the Congress vis-a-vis the White House, the price for not addressing the Congress on such a crucial and important issue that we really believe is a strategic threat for the state of Israel, this price for not addressing the Congress is going to be more expensive.
And the fact that elections are happening on March 17th in Israel and the speech is happening just before these elections, can you understand how people could see this as a political ploy? Are we missing something about the timing of this speech?
I think you're missing something. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is such a major issue in the Israeli elections. Indeed, those are extremely important elections. We say it about every elections in Israel, but this time it's really true. I think it is more a political, hot potato here between, unfortunately, it is considered to be kind of a part of the tension between Democrats and Republicans here. And we don't want to be part of this game.
Well, there are some who say that by getting involved in domestic politics, it could threaten what is really, as you said yourself, the very, very special relationship between Israel and the U.S. And we know that support for Israel was very strongly bipartisan in the United States Congress. We saw a recent CNN poll that finds 63% of Americans oppose Prime Minister Netanyahu speaking to Congress. Is it worth risking that special bipartisan relationship to do this?
And there is another new poll of Bloomberg that shows that the situation, that's not true, that most Americans, as much as they are unhappy with the way it was done, by the way, I don't want to get into the politics, but we were under the impression that Speaker Boehner will take upon himself to inform the White House. And from the best of my understanding, I didn't attend the conversation, but I understand that's how it was presented to us. So we didn't want to create this blunder with the White House. The White House is extremely important for us, as is the Congress and as is the American people. But we do feel, as they say in the legal world, that we want to have our day in court. And we believe that on this specific issue of the Iranian track, America or the current administration is going the wrong way. And we believe, Prime Minister Netanyahu believes, that we should have the right podium to address the legislative branch in the United States. Again, we are extremely unhappy that it became such a hot political potato. But again, in the long run, I believe that Israel, just as it was in the past, will be bipartisan, a portfolio, something that bridge both sides of the aisle. I spoke with many Republican congressmen that were unhappy, and I spoke with Democratic congressmen and women that were happy that Mr. Netanyahu is coming to town, if you want. So we understand the sensitivity, but for us, the major challenge is the Iranian one, and we believe that the bilateral relationship between us and the United States will manage to prevail and will manage to sustain for good.
I'd like to shift attention to some of the incredibly terrible headlines and attacks on Jews in France and Denmark. And the Prime Minister made some international headlines when he called for Jews in Europe to come home and live in Israel. And those who support those comments say, well, it's Netanyahu who is more than just the leader of the nation, but he's the leader and the protector of all Jews around the world. Do we take that and kind of imply that for American Jews, the United States really isn't their true first homeland? How do we respond to that?
Look, I don't want to get into this issue of double loyalty. Let me just say something that for me as an Israeli citizen, as a Jew, as an Israeli diplomat, is very basic. Israel is different, is a different state in the sense that it's not only a state for the 8 million people that lives in Israel, among them 6.4 million Jews and 1.6 million Arabs, but the state is much bigger than that. That's why we call it the Jewish state. We have some responsibility for Jewish people all over the world. And what we say is very simple. We say Israel is a safety net. If something goes wrong in France, if something goes wrong in Belgium, if something goes wrong in Denmark. Look, Cindy, only a year ago I attended a ceremony in Kansas City where the Jewish campus was attacked. Three people were killed, assassinated. Non-Jews, by the way. Eric Holder was there, the general attorney. And things can go wrong also here in America. And in that case, Israel is a safety net. Israel is a place for all world Jewry. Does this mean that there will not be Jews in Denmark or in Belgium or in France or in Kansas? Of course there will be. There will always be. And for those who would like to stay, that's fine. I think Israel is also in a better position to establish a dialogue with foreign governments to make sure that they will make sure that the Jewish people who live there will be protected. So as a state, I think we have a better stand to establish a dialogue with different governments to make sure that the Jews who would like to stay will be protected, and we are doing so. At the same time, thousands of French Jews have moved to Israel in the last year, and I expect this number to be bigger. So we do not impose our agenda. Jewish people in the diaspora can do whatever they want, and we respect it. But for those who would like to make, as we call, aliyah, to immigrate to Israel, we welcome them with open arms.
As these horrific headlines and stories have been happening, what are you hearing from American Jews, the people that you meet? Is there a sense of alarm, or is there a sense of concern as we see what's happening in other parts of the world?
I think there is a growing sense of concern among Jewish people all over the world. Among the biggest Jewish community in the world, which is in Israel, among the second biggest Jewish community in the world, which is in the U.S., and among the third biggest Jewish community in the world, which is in Europe. Jewish people all over the world are concerned. Again, for the time being, this plague did not cross the Atlantic Ocean, but that can happen. And I think nowadays, I don't want to exaggerate, but I think in Europe it is unpleasant to be a Jew in certain states, which I don't want to name them here, but I think everybody knows what I'm talking about. You know, me growing up in Israel, as a Jew in Israel, I didn't face much of what Jewish people are facing nowadays in Europe, but I'd say we have a huge responsibility here to make sure the Jewish people will feel safe wherever they are in Europe.
Roei Gilad is the Consul General of Israel to the Midwest. It was good to meet you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Cindy, for hosting me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Skahn. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.